Egypt.
That was the whitest thing you've ever done.
I don't know why, but I had a mic and I was like, I need to beatbox.
That was beatbox. Fuck you. Holy shit.
This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
This podcast.
Our podcast.
You right.
The only podcast you should listen to.
And this week, we're here.
Well, we're here every week, Morgan. If you didn't know,
we're here.
We've been here before.
What are you binging this week, friend?
So this week I am binging season 3 of Big Mouth.
Nice, nice.
It is hilarious as always.
Yeah.
Graphic as always. There's an episode with the Fab Five from Queer Eye, which is really good.
Yeah.
And they make over Coach Steve. and I'm almost done with it. I think we have just like 2 or 3 episodes left.
Right.
But it's just as good. Like, they just keep delivering, and I'm happy about it.
I started season 3, and then I got preoccupied. I only got, like, 3 episodes in, and I was like, this feels even more graphic than I remember it.
It is. They do have a game show-like vibe in one of the episodes where, like, she's trying to masturbate for the first time, and it's like it's like the yodeler game from The Price is Right, and it's like once he reaches the top, then she orgasms, and it's a lot.
It is a lot, but it's a good show. It's very funny.
It's funny.
What
are you binging?
Well,
I already know.
Shara. That's your new name.
That's fine.
Sarah already knows because I'm a big old nerd and I keep talking about
it. Yeah, and she's been binging it, which means she's talking about it.
Yeah, but if you don't want to hear me be the nerdiest person possible, just skip forward like 30 seconds.
No, you have to listen or else you're banned from the rest of the episode.
Oh, there it is. We're going to somehow implement that with our Spotify. No, but I've been binging something called Critical Role, which is, I believe it's like live streamed on Twitch and then uploaded to YouTube.
Okay.
So I watch it on YouTube. But it's basically like, depending on the week, 7 to 8 voice actors who, it's the same people every week, get together and they play like a game of D&D. And it's great because, like, all of the actors are so committed to being their character. Like, there's one guy who just talks like his character the whole game, like, never comes out of it. And it's great. And it's very funny. And I love it. And each episode is, like, 4 hours long.
Oh, wow. I was about to ask you how long they are.
I started last Sunday, and I'm up to episode 15.
Wow.
But I also like watch it all day at work.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
I can, like, my job doesn't require that much
thinking
that I can't watch it. But they're also doing this thing where if you roll a natural one, which is like a terrible roll, they donate $100 to this organization, 826LA. And they've already raised $40,000.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It's awesome.
That's a great cause.
Yeah. So it's really cool. And it's also very fun because you get to watch a bunch of funny people play a game.
Yeah.
And it gets wild. So
because like when you first mentioned this to me, I used to watch, I can never remember the name of it.
Dan Harmon. Yeah.
And so I'm assuming it's something kind of similar, but different people, different game, everything.
Yeah, like it's similar, but I think most of Dan Harmon's are like one-offs now instead of like a whole campaign, which is like a story that goes on and on. But I don't know for sure.
And I think during Dan Harmon's, they like animate part of it.
They do animate it, whereas this, you're like just watching the actors sit at their table and like play the game.
Okay.
So it's fun though. I like it. And it brings me much joy.
And Morgan's a, a big old nerd.
It's true. When I told my brother that I've been playing D&D, because he's 12 years older than me, he was like, why? And I was like, because it's fun. He's like, I used to get beat up for playing that fucking game. How dare you appropriate my culture?
Yeah, but now you're an adult, so yeah, no so one can beat you up.
Exactly. But that was a rant of a lifetime. This week, we are going to cover...
Matthew Shepard.
Yes. Who was a very important person in like the LGBT community and in getting laws changed to better like help the LGBT community, right?
Yeah, because of his death.
Yeah. So it's a very sad story, but it has like a good outcome.
Yeah.
So it's lightly uplifting while still being sad.
So we're going to start off with Matthew Shepard's early life, just like we do with everyone else. He was born Matthew Wayne Shepard on December 1st of 1976 in Casper, Wyoming. His parents were Judy and Dennis, and he had a little brother, Logan, who was born in 1981, and Matthew and Logan were very close. He was described as sensitive, soft-spoken, kind young boy.
Yeah.
He attended Crest Hill Elementary School, Dean Morgan Junior High School, and Natrona?
Sure.
Natrona County High School, all in Casper, Wyoming. And although he was a sweet boy and he was described as being friendly with all of his classmates, he was often bullied for being smaller in stature and lacking athleticism.
Yeah. Which, like, Taylor, he, up until he was, like, I think 16 or 17, was, like, 5 feet.
Oh, wow.
And then, like, sprung up.
Yeah.
So he can, like, low-key relate to that. Yeah.
So during Matthew's junior year in 1994... the family actually moved to,
Dhahran.
Yeah. Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, where Matthew's father got a job with Saudi Aramco.
Sure.
Aramco, where he worked in oil safety engineering.
Which, like, when I was researching this, I was like, I've heard, like, the Matthew Shepard thing a lot, but obviously, why would I know this? But I was like, what the fuck?
He completed high school at the American School in Switzerland. And while here, he took theater, Italian, and German classes, and he enjoyed music and fashion. He graduated in May of 1995, and he was described by his father as being an optimistic and accepting young man who had a special gift of relating to almost everyone. He was the type of person who was very approachable and always looked to new challenges. Matthew had a great passion for equality and always stood up for the acceptance of people's differences.
Also, I'm just going to mention here, when I was taking notes, like right before they went into the sentence, they said that Matthew was Episcopalian.
Yes.
But that was the only sentence about it. And I tried looking up like how important his faith was to him and I couldn't really find a ton.
Yeah,
so I'm assuming if they mentioned it, he had, like, a faith that was important to him, but I'm not entirely certain.
Yeah, the only other thing that I read about it was that his, like, the person who was the preacher at his funeral was, like, the first gay Episcopalian preacher.
Okay, that's cool.
So, during Matthew's senior year of high school in 1995... he took a trip with three of his friends to Morocco. During this trip, Matthew was beaten, robbed, and raped by a gang of locals. Friends say that Matthew's petite stature, being only 5'2 and 100 pounds, made him vulnerable to victimization. Although police got involved, they tried to find the perpetrators, but they were never caught. This led to him experiencing depression and anxiety, often having panic attacks, which he did seek therapy for, but he still experienced these feelings.
Which I feel like is common after you've been beaten, robbed, and raped, you know?
Definitely. He was hospitalized multiple times due to his clinical depression and suicidal thoughts. And his friends later said that they feared his depression had driven him to become more involved with drugs during his time in college.
Which, drugs don't always help mental illness. Yeah. So,
but they are a common coping mechanism.
Yeah, for sure. So, going into his, like, time in college, after graduating from high school, Matthew attended a liberal arts school, which was Catawba. Okay, sure. Catawba College in Salisbury, North Carolina, which is just like...
Is that where the Salisbury steak was invented?
Yes. He went here to pursue a career in theater. And during this time, he came out to his mother as gay, even though he had known that he was from an early age. And his mother was actually accepting of this and reassured that she had known for many years and was just waiting until he was ready to tell her to talk about it with them. So that's nice, yeah. You know? He briefly moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, before moving back home to attend community college at Casper College. At Casper, a teacher introduced Matthew to a woman named Romaine Patterson. She was an outgoing lesbian who quickly became one of Matthew's closest friends. The two moved together to Denver, Colorado, where Matthew worked a string of part-time jobs, but he knew that his passion in life was helping people and wanted to pursue something that would help him do that. In 1998, Matthew moved to Laramie and enrolled at the University of Wyoming, which was his parents' alma mater. He thought that moving to a small town of Laramie would help him feel safe, actually, and here he became a first-year political science major at the University of Wyoming. He also minored in languages and was chosen as the student representative of the Wyoming Environmental Council. Which is nice. Mm-hmm. Like, he was just a genuinely nice person.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
He also studied international relations and wanted to pursue a foreign service career. Matthew was known around campus as polite, thoughtful, and a great conversationalist. He quickly became active on campus and joined the university's LGBT Student Alliance. And also, this is like the... late 90s, so it wasn't like LGBTQ+, which is why we're going to call it, yeah, LGBT.
So, going into his unfortunate death, on October 6th of 1998, Matthew was approached by Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson at the Fireside Lounge in Laramie. It has since come under new management and is a different establishment, but it was believed to be, like, the local bar.
Yeah, because I, like, went searching for it, and it was just, like, it referenced the murder and mm-hmm. nothing really about it.
So, the three men were in their early 20s, and it was originally thought that the men's plans were to rob Matthew, as they saw him as an easy target. And it is also rumored that the men posed as gay in order to lure Matthew into going with them. And so they offered him a ride home, and Matthew agreed. Instead, the two men drove him to a remote rural area in the Sherman Hills development area in East Laramie. Here, they proceeded to rob him, pistol whip, and torture him, and tied him to a split rail fence, leaving him to die. McKinney started the assault by punching and pistol whipping Matthew. Then, by McKinney's instructions, Henderson tied Matthew to the fence with white clothesline, and McKinney continued the beating. When the men were done, they stole Matthew's wallet, identification, and shoes. The men then made their way back to Laramie at 12:30 a.m.
Which, like, they're already, like, really cowardly and shitty, but they're also, like, really fucking dumb.
Yeah.
With everything that they took, and it'll come back to bite them in the ass, but it's just, like, such, like, I don't know. With serial killers, like, we can make fun of them, but mm-hmm. with this, it's just, like, sad, yeah, you know? Yeah, because
it's just, like, two guys being fucking stupid.
Yeah, like, two guys who just can't handle the fact that someone might be different from them mm-hmm. and, like, have to be terrible people about it.
So the media contained the graphic account of the pistol whipping damage to Matthew's face that caused a fractured skull. It was also reported that his face was beaten so brutally that his face was completely covered in blood except from where his tears were.
And to me, I feel like that is like maybe sensationalized to make people like feel even worse. I don't know. It could very well be true, though. It's just an interesting fact that would be hard to kind of prove, mm-hmm. you know?
After attacking Shepard, leaving him in near freezing temperatures, the men returned to town and proceeded to pick a fight with two Hispanic youths, Emilio Morales and Jeremy Herrera. The fight resulted in head wounds for McKinney and Morales. A police officer, Flint Walters, arrived at the scene of the fight. He arrested Henderson and then searched McKinney's truck. There, he found a blood-smeared gun along with Shepard's shoes and a credit card.
And identity.
Yeah.
Like, I think I forgot that, but also his ID.
So, at this time, Shepard was still tied to the fence and was discovered 18 hours later in a coma by a cyclist, Aaron Krefels, who initially mistook him for a scarecrow. It's like, it's never a scarecrow, it's never a mannequin.
Yeah, it's just what your mind is telling you, so you don't have to deal with the fact that you just stumbled upon this horrible thing.
And I also read that, like, because his face was so caked in blood, that when he realized it wasn't a scarecrow, that they thought it was a child.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Azula, leave her alone.
It'd be fine if she stopped messing with my phone. So the first police officer to arrive at the scene was Reggie Flutie. She was given medical gloves by the Albany County Sheriff's Department and her supply had run out. So she decided to use her bare hands to clear an airway in his bloody mouth. A day later, she was informed that Shepard was actually HIV positive and she would have to go through a series of tests to see if she was now positive. At the time, she had several cuts on her hands, but the tests eventually tested negative. Shepard's mother learned of his HIV status while he was dying in the hospital.
Which is sad.
Mm-hmm.
He was transported to Ivinson Memorial Hospital in Laramie before being moved to a more advanced trauma unit in Poudre Valley Hospital of Fort Collins, Colorado. When his parents were notified of the attack, they were in Saudi Arabia and had to make the 36-hour journey back to the U.S., which, can you imagine, like, hearing your son has been hurt and then you have to fly 36 mm-hmm. hours to go see him? That would be, like, the worst feeling.
Yeah, just so nerve-wracking the entire time. It's just like, why can't this plane go faster?
Yeah. During their trip back, news of the attack spread from local media to actually nationwide. They were baffled to see this news of their son's attack across newspaper headlines in their layover at the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. By the time his parents had reached the hospital, there was a vigil of media and well-wishers in front of the hospital, and President Bill Clinton had sent his best wishes to the family. He had suffered fractures to the back of his head and to the right front of his ear, or the front of his right ear. He also experienced severe brain damage, which affected his body's ability to regulate his heart rate, body temperature, and other vital functions. There were about a dozen small lacerations around his head, face, and neck, and his injuries were so severe that doctors actually couldn't operate on him for fear that his body would go into shock and immediately die. This cat is, like, freaking out right now.
20 minutes later.
So moving on to the arrests and trial. His two attackers, McKinney and Henderson, were originally arrested with attempted murder, kidnapping, and aggravated robbery. After Shepard died, the charges were upgraded from attempted murder to first-degree murder, which meant they were both eligible for the death penalty. Their girlfriends, Kristen Price, who was McKinney's girlfriend, and Chastity Paisley, who was Henderson's girlfriend, were also charged with being accessories after the fact. During the trial, these women testified that neither of the men were under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time of the attack, which I don't think is true.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And they also, but they also got arrested for lying to the cops, too.
Yeah.
They also tried to persuade their girlfriends to provide alibis for them and help dispose of evidence. In November 1998, McKinney had a pretrial hearing. Sergeant Rob Debrey testified that in an interview on October 9th, McKinney stated that he and Henderson identified Matthew as an easy robbery target and pretended to be gay to lure him out of the truck. He also stated that he began to attack Matthew when Matthew put his hand on McKinney's knee. Detective Ben Fritzen also testified that McKinney's girlfriend, Kristen Price, stated in an interview that McKinney told her that the attack against Matthew resulted in how he felt about gays.
And you know that McKinney is the type of guy who puts his hand on the thigh of any fucking woman he wants to at the bar. So even if that was your excuse, it's a poor fucking excuse.
In December of 1998, Chastity Paisley, who was 21 and Russell Henderson's girlfriend, pleaded guilty of being an accessory after the fact to first-degree murder and received 18 months in prison. Paisley said that she first learned of the attack listening to McKinney and Henderson try and get their stories straight at McKinney's apartment that night. She said she had second thoughts and was mad at herself for getting involved, as the next day she went with Henderson and Kristen Price to the neighboring town of Cheyenne, Wyoming, to dump Henderson's clothes in a gas station dumpster. She said when dumping the clothes, she saw blood and a fleshy substance on the knee of one of his pant legs.
That's disgusting.
Mm-hmm. They also hid Henderson's new expensive shoes that he had been wearing in a shed that her mother owned in Cheyenne. Like, instead of throwing them out, you hide them because they're his new expensive shoes.
Well, yeah. As soon as the investigation's over, he gets to wear his new fucking expensive shoes, yeah, Sarah. Right? He's smart as fuck.
I know. So, she said that Henderson tried to reassure her, telling her, quote, "It's all right. He's okay." Referring to Matthew. During her testimony, McKinney remained slouched forward at the defense table. He had actually not gone with a three when dumping the clothes because he was being treated at the hospital for his skull fracture and a concussion from the fight they were in. The day after her testimony for McKinney, eight detectives showed up to the apartment that she shared with Henderson and arrested her.
Damn.
Imagine eight detectives coming to your apartment.
That's fucking fantastic.
She had also admitted to police that she had lied during questioning when she had stuck to the story that her and Price made up for the night of the beating, saying they were watching movies together and knew nothing of the attack. Paisley said that she lied because, quote, "I was protecting someone I loved."
Yeah.
Yep. That's, I mean,
whatever. That's why you got 18 months. Sorry.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why you went to jail.
On April 5th of 1999, Russell Henderson avoided going to trial by pleading guilty to murder and kidnapping charges. He reached a plea deal which took the death penalty off of the table, in which he agreed to testify against McKinney and was sentenced by District Judge Jeffrey A. Donnell to two consecutive life terms in prison. At his sentencing, Henderson's lawyer argued that Matthew's attack had not been because he was gay. During his trial, Russell got to tell his side of the story and speak to Matthew's parents. Russell's grandmother spoke as a character witness to him, and Matthew's parents got to address Russell and the judge. Russell recounted what happened that night, saying, "It was 10 p.m., and Aaron and I decided to go out to a bar." The Fireside Bar was the second bar that they had actually gone out to that night, after drinking a couple pitchers of beer at the first. There, while drinking another pitcher, Mr. McKinney noticed the college student, Matthew, and he said, "Aaron had mentioned to me that he wanted to take him out and rob him. I disagreed with this." McKinney told him where to drive the truck to and where to park it. Aaron McKinney pulled out a gun and told Matthew Shepard to give him his wallet. After parking, McKinney pulled Matthew out of the truck and continued to hit him with the pistol. Aaron told me to get the rope out of the truck and tie his hands. Matthew looked really bad. I told him to stop, but Mr. McKinney hit me above the mouth. I returned to the truck. I like that he's referring to him as Mr. McKinney because he wants to sound all proper in court. Next, Russell's grandmother, Lucy Thompson, who had raised Russell since he was a baby, appealed to the court. She talked about how Russell was loving and kind and was not hateful. She recounted many times of Russell playing with his smaller cousins and how he wasn't afraid to hug and kiss her as a teenager, even in front of her friend or in front of his friends. She then spoke to Matthew's parents. Our hearts ache for the pain and suffering the Shepherds have gone through. We have prayed for you many, many times. You have shown us much mercy. I want to thank all the Shepherds. I love you even though I have never known you. Then she turned to the judge and pleaded for him not to take him out of our lives forever. Which, like, Matthew was also a really nice kid whose family loved him, you know?
Yeah. Russell then spoke again, this time addressing Matthew's parents, saying, Mr. and Mrs. Shepherd, there is not a moment that doesn't go by that I don't see what happened that night. I know what I did. I'm very sorry for what I did. I'm ready to pay for what I did.
Me trying to reach a word count on a paper.
Right. So Mrs. Shepherd got to speak next, recounting the time she had with her son and his interest in politics, theater, and international culture. She said, he wasn't my son, my firstborn anymore. He was my friend, my confidant, my constant reminder of how good life could be. She talked about the last time she saw Matthew, covered in bandages and wired with tubes in the ICU, saying, one of his eyes were partially open. I could see the clear blue of his eye, but the twinkle of his life wasn't there anymore. She then faced Russell and said, at times, I don't think you are worthy of addressing. We won't allow you to kill our family.
Damn.
I cried when I first, like, when I was typing these notes, I was like, ugh. It was intense.
It is really intense.
So, Mr. Shepherd was the last to testify. And he'd actually written something on the plane.
Yeah.
On the way. And he, like, threw it out. In an impromptu speech to Russell, he said, my son was born blind. Not physically blind, but blind to people's differences. Short or tall, black, brown, or white, religion, or ethnic backgrounds. His friends included gays and so-called straights. It takes a brave man to tie up another man who did not know how to clench a fist until he was 13 years old.
Damn.
Also, I love the and so-called straights.
Yeah.
Love it, because everyone's a little bit gay.
It's true.
Cal Rirucha, the prosecution's closing remarks were short. He was the prosecuting attorney.
Yeah.
He told Russell, Mr. Henderson, you have created hell on earth for a family, for our county, for the state. Judge Donald told Henderson, you are deserving the foolish punishment this court can mete out. This court does not believe you feel any true remorse in this matter. Then, after sentencing Henderson to the harsher sentence, two consecutive life sentences instead of two concurrent ones, he told Russell, you are not a victim here, Mr. Russell. You are a perpetrator.
Damn straight, yep. Judge.
But on a little bit of a lighter note,
yeah.
Today, Russell Henderson is living out his jail sentence at a medium security prison in Torrington, Wyoming. And he's taken the empathy path. He's even written apology letters to Mrs. Shepherd. He spends his time in prison working with jailed hospice patients and volunteering training shelter dogs. He said in a 2009 interview that he believes that the United States should revamp its federal hate crime laws to protect everyone. And he stated in the same interview, "I think about Matthew every single day of my life. I think about him and every single one of those days that I've had, that he hasn't had, that his family hasn't had, his friends haven't had. I'm so, so ashamed I was ever part of this."
That's nice that he's like taking the empathy route, but you still did it.
Yeah.
You know? But
going on to McKinney.
Yeah. I mean, McKinney is definitely the bigger perpetrator in this.
Ends up taking the opposite route.
Yeah. I mean, from the beginning, we knew he 100%. Would take the opposite route. Like, Russell was just a guy who, like,
was along for the ride.
Not even, like, he just let his friend control him.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to be involved in that in any way.
Yeah, he could have, like, driven away or...
Yeah, or just, like, punched his friend in the face and be like, no, you're gonna fucking stop. Yeah. Like, sorry, if you tried to get me to beat up someone and tie him to a rope, I'd be like, or fence, I'd be like, nah, man, I'm good.
So, if I killed someone, you wouldn't help me hide the body?
It'd have to be a really good reason.
not just someone in the bar.
Yeah, like, you can't just kill for funsies or a random person. Yeah. It'd have to be a really good reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
McKinney chose to proceed to trial, and his trial took place in October and November of 1999. McKinney's girlfriend, Kristen Price, testified that Henderson and McKinney pretended to be gay to get Shepard in the truck and rob him. McKinney's lawyer attempted to put forward a gay panic defense, saying that McKinney was driven to temporary insanity by alleged sexual advances by Shepard. The judge shut this down really fucking quickly, though, and rejected that defense. The defense then countered by saying that McKinney was sexually abused by an older male neighborhood bully when he was 7 and had a confusing experience with the male cousin when he was 15, and that because of his previous homosexual experiences, McKinney went into a rage when Shepard allegedly came on to him.
Which is bullshit.
And, like, I don't know Matthew Shepard at all, obviously, but to me, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would just randomly come on to a bunch of people unless they did fake that he was gay.
Yeah, I mean, like, even just, like, putting your hand on someone's knee is not, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it could make you uncomfortable, hence The Office where Toby puts his hand on Pam's knee makes everyone in the room uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But it's not, like... He's not groping you or anything like
that. Yeah. It's just a silly excuse.
Mm-hmm.
McKinney's lawyer stated that the men wanted to rob Shepard, but never intended on killing him. The prosecuting attorney argued this, saying that the killing had been premeditated, driven by greed and violence. The jury found McKinney not guilty of premeditated murder, but guilty of felony murder, and they deliberated the death penalty. Shepard's parents brokered a deal, resulting in McKinney receiving 2 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole, just like Henderson, because they're good people.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew's father spoke to McKinney after the possibility of parole, just like Henderson. Oops, what? What is wrong with me? I'm drunk. It's because I'm not wearing my glasses.
Jeez, nope,
it took
not.
Me this whole fucking time to realize it. Matthew's father spoke to McKinney after the deal was made. "I would like nothing better than to see you die, Mr. McKinney, but now is the time to heal. Every time you wake up in your cell, remember you had the opportunity to stop your actions that night. Mr. McKinney, you will not become a symbol. Just a miserable symbol and more miserable end. That's fine with me." McKinney did the same interview that Henderson did in 2009 and had a different outlook than Henderson did. He made it very clear that the attack was a hate crime and that he showed no remorse. He admitted that on the night of the attack, Henderson and him zeroed in on Shepard because he was obviously gay and that it played a part, his weakness, his frailty. He also said in the interview, "The night I did it, I did have hatred for homosexuals." He admitted after the robbery and initial beating, "After that, he mouthed off, so I hit him a few more times and his fag ass died." which is just
so like 15, 20 years later, he's still like,
yeah,
calling this guy homophobic names.
Yeah. I felt wrong saying that.
Yeah.
That made my skin crawl. McKinney is currently serving his time in a Mississippi state prison and denied any further interviews. Kristen Price was the last of the four to be arrested. She was originally charged with accessory after the fact to first-degree murder, just like Paisley, after helping to dispose of Henderson's bloody clothes. But her charges were dropped and she pled guilty to a misdemeanor of interfering with a police officer after being a viable witness and testifying against her boyfriend, Aaron McKinney. She received 180 days in jail, with 120 of those being time served after the initial arrest, and the remaining 60 days were suspended. So she did not spend any more time in jail after pleading guilty, which is kind of bullshit.
It definitely is. So lastly, we wanted to talk about Matthew Shepard's legacy. Because his attack attracted so much media coverage, Matthew's death ended up being front and center on the outcry of anti-gay hate and violence. During the time of the attack and trials, the United States and Wyoming did have hate crime laws, but they only covered crimes against race, color, religion, and ethnicity, and not sexual orientation, which is why the men were not convicted of hate crimes. In the years following her death, Judy Shepard worked as an advocate for LGBT rights. Her and her husband, Dennis, founded the Matthew Shepard Foundation in 1998. The mission of the foundation is for individuals to embrace human dignity and diversity and to replace hate with understanding, compassion, and acceptance. Matthew's younger brother, Logan, is a staff member of the foundation and currently oversees its day-to-day operations.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. I like that.
That he's involved.
Yeah, that the like whole family is involved.
Matthew's death was cited by figures in the gay rights movement as a prime example for the need for more expansive hate crime laws across the United States. In 2007, the Local Law Enforcement Hate Crimes Prevention Act was introduced to address these shortcomings in federal law. Although the law was passed by the House of Representatives, it was delayed because of widespread Republican opposition, including from President George Bush, who threatened to veto it. Which is trash.
Yeah.
In 2009, a modified version of the bill was finally approved by the House and Senate and was signed into legislation by President Barack Obama. The legislation passed by a vote of 68-29 on October 22nd, and it was signed by Barack Obama on October 28th, 2009. The legislation was officially known as the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009. And James Byrd Jr. was an African-American who was brutally murdered by three white supremacists in 1998.
That happened the same year as Matthew, right?
Mm-hmm. So the new legislation expanded the definition of the federal hate crime law by including crimes instigated by an individual's perceived gender or gender identity and revising the collection standards for biases motivated by sexual orientation, race, and ethnicity. The act gives the Department of Justice the ability to investigate and prosecute bias-motivated violent crimes against LGBT victims. Because of concerns, this part's real sad.
It is really sad.
Because of concerns that his grave would be vandalized, Shepard was not buried until...
Buried? Who the fuck are you?
I'm from the South, apparently. Was not buried until last year, October 26, 2018. So just a year ago.
Yeah.
His ashes were interred into the crypt of the Washington National Cathedral, and his were the first interment of the ashes of a national figure at the cathedral since Helen Keller's 50 years earlier.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And so, like, they are also considering him a national figure.
Yeah.
In June 2019, so just a couple months ago, Shepherd was one of the 50 inaugural pioneers, trailblazers, and heroes inducted into the National LGBT Wall of Honor within the Stonewall National Monument at New York City's Stonewall Inn. The Stonewall National Monument is the first U.S. national monument dedicated to LGBT rights and history. The wall's unveiling was timed to take place during the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots.
That's really awesome.
Yeah. And so we also just kind of wanted to let you know before we go into our fun, light Florida man story.
Right.
That the Matthew Shepherd Foundation is still currently being run and is holding events for support and awareness. And you can go online and check out their causes and events and even donate to them if you can at MatthewShepherd.org.
Yeah.
And that would be something really nice.
Yeah. And we highly suggest, like, donating if you can. Like, even $5 helps if you can't donate a lot. I feel like I wasn't very, like, on this week because that one is just so sad, you know?
Yeah, you can't, like, you can't even make fun of anyone. You can't try and be funny.
Yeah, like, it's just, and I'm not funny in general, so.
Me either.
With a real serious topic like this, it's harder when it's about, like, a real person and not, like, a serial killer because you don't care about them.
Yeah.
You
know? And we wanted to cover it because, like, just the couple months ago, he was,
yeah,
like, inaugurated, and just a couple, like, 2 weeks ago from the time we're recording this was the 21st anniversary of his death, and so we thought it would be nice to cover this.
Yeah. So, are you ready for my Florida man?
I am. Lighten us up.
Florida man wears fuck the police shirt to court and wins case.
Me? Oh, wow.
So the actual, like, reason why is not great. So Michael Burns of Broward County says that he was videotaping police officers kicking people off public property after being told by one of the cops that they were trying to ruin their fun. He said one of the officers on the scene told him that he had to leave, although he believed he wasn't legally obligated to do so. Burns says he was determined that there wasn't much else to do to record, and he decided to go. So he was, like, recording the police being shitty. As he was pulling out, a Broward County sheriff began following him. He claims that he slowed down all the way down to 15 under, but the cop maintained following him. And according to Burns' account, he was about to make a U-turn to head home when the same cop who told him to leave the scene of videotaping pulled him over, and six other cop cars pulled up and surrounded his car. Basically, this guy, like, submitted this video to a website called LiveLeak, and the cop got pissed and was, like, telling him to take it down and stuff. So he went to jail, and he wore this shirt. He, when he appeared at his hearing wearing a black t-shirt with fuck the police across the back, he got cleared for his violation that the police wrote him. And the article person writing this says, well, it must be nice to be white. And they go, as an African-American, I'd never walk into a courtroom demonstrating such open defiance and disrespect.
You're not wrong, though.
Yeah, they aren't.
That is 100% white privilege.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it made me laugh.
Yeah. And so, I like how it was written on the back so that way the cops could see it, but the judge couldn't see
it. For sure. I'm sure, like, he turned around and the judge was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
That Pikachu surprise face meme. But we hope that you enjoyed our story this week, friends. And if you want to hang out with us on social media, hit us up on crimebinge@gmail.com and then on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya. That was a much deeper see ya than normal.
That was a very deep.